Hello, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading Voices of the Commonwealth, a special podcast produced by the Armin Benevolent Fund for Remembrance Sunday. 2024 is the 75th anniversary of the London Declaration, which established the Commonwealth of Nations as an international association of 56 independent and equal countries with a combined population of 2.7 billion that spans the globe. In Voices of the Commonwealth, the Armin Benevolent Fund pays tribute to and gives thanks for the significant contribution and great sacrifice that citizens of the Commonwealth have made and continue to make in the defence of freedom. This is their story. There are approximately 9,000 to 12,000 Commonwealth and non-British citizens serving in our armed forces today, or just under 10%. But it is important to note that before so much as stepping inside a barrack gate, let alone donning uniform, each and every one of those men and women serving today, or for that matter, those who have gone before, or those who are yet to volunteer, has made a conscious decision to bid farewell to their place of birth, home and families, leave the sun behind them, travel half around the world to a cold country where more often than not it rains, swear an oath of allegiance to a monarch whose daily influence until that moment was little more than an image on a banknote, while volunteering to serve in an army that could end up fighting in some remote corner of the world that has nothing whatsoever to do with either them or the distant peaceful territory from which they have come. Staff Sergeant Melissa Forrester Frame, Queen Alexandra's Royal Army Nursing Corps, who is also part of the Army Multicultural Network, which supports ethnic minority soldiers and offers advice to leadership and policy teams.
So I came in England in 2005, and it was around the same time Grenada, where I'm originally from, was struck twice by hurricanes. So it was quite hard, even before that, trying to find a job. So then I decided to then stay and try to join the army, because around that time, there was quite a lot of influx of persons from the Caribbean and other Commonwealth countries being enlisted into the army. At that time, my brother and a few other persons I knew from my own country and community were also part of the army. So then I decided to give it a go. Unfortunately, when I first tried, there was no vacancy at the time. And then I was told to reapply. And then about 6 months to a year later, they had sent and said, okay, there is vacancies. So I went and applied. The role that I wanted to go in, which I had studied at college, was not available. And that's how I ended up in the medical field. And I've been there now 17 years and looking for the future.
You're getting a feel for it anyway.
Yeah.
What was your family's reaction when you said that you were going to join the British Army?
I think my dad was okay with it. However, my mom was quite hesitant because it was around the time of Afghan Iraq. Mm. And you, as a parent, you wouldn't want your child going in war, and especially being in different countries or not really understanding the whole concept of the army. So my mom was very worried. My dad was less, because obviously my elder brother, which is his son, was already serving and had been to Iraq at the time also. So he wasn't that much concerned, to be honest. A bit, but not as much as my mom.
How do you find that adapting to the climate?
To be honest, I'm still adapting. So weather just changes rapidly. But I think... because when I came in the March month, so it was still cold. However, there was clear days, and seeing outside clear and feeling like the sun through the glass, I will think, oh, it's warm outside. And then I'll go outside and get the shock of my life. Like, the cold is not my friend. Let's just say that.
The New Dimension Steel Orchestra performing at the Steel Pan Easter Jamboree in 2012 on Grenada, home to Staff Sergeant Melissa Forrester Frame.
Commonwealth involvement in British Army and the Armed Forces, it goes back many, many years. How do you think that has influenced and perhaps helped shape the current state of our armed forces today?
I think it has helped, because the thing is, to working with persons in a team and which army they push, or the Ministry of Defense, like we all a team. We are a diverse society, and in order to reflect such, you have to then adapt to certain cultures, or not even really fully adapt, but to understand the cultures. Because even though I may be from the Caribbean, I'm from Grenada, but I might do something different to somebody who is from Jamaica or even somebody from Africa. So I think with the Ministry of Defense and especially the Army, understanding the way in which cultures operates helps a better have a better fighting force.
Of all the different Commonwealth countries, who do you think, who are the most characterful, who stand out in there in different ways?
So I think for Commonwealth, the country for my as well will stand out the most is the Jamaicans.
What do you miss most about serving so far from home?
I think the warm weather and my family. The warm weather and my family.
It's over 8,000 miles from the Caribbean to the Republic of Fiji in the South Pacific, which are 10,000 miles from Britain. 40 years ago, our first Coldstream was stationed in Hong Kong as part of 48 Gurkha Infantry Brigade. It was my privilege to serve, train and live fire for 2 months in the Fijian Islands. No story about the Commonwealth involvement with our armed forces would be complete without acknowledgement of the great and noble Fijian people. Nima Lakeri from Viti Levu, Fiji's main island, who joined the Royal Pioneer Corps and now serves for the Military Province Guard Service, applying to the British Army was a gift from his mother on his 21st birthday over 20 years ago.
Bula.
Bula, Bula Vinak.
So how are you today?
Yeah, I'm good, sir. I'm good, yeah.
You served for 10 and a half years initially in the Royal Pioneer Corps. You joined in 2001. What was your reasons for travelling over 11,000 miles from Suva, from Fiji, to come to London to join the British Army? Why did you join the Army?
When I grew up, I was thinking of joining the Fiji Army instead of British Army. Because all of my uncles or my dad's brothers, they mainly joined the Fiji Army. Yeah, start from my grandfather and downwards. So it's one of the things I was when I was growing up. I said to myself, "Yeah, I'm gonna join the Fiji Army." But little did I know that God has something else different, rather than just the Fijian Army. So yes, an opportunity came to Fiji. I was away helping my granddad in the farm. It's like the other side of Fiji called Vanuatu. Yeah, and I was in the farm. I didn't even know that my mom was preparing this for me to come here before we send emails and electronic side of it. We use we just letter or we fill up paper and 3 months or 4 months, we will receive it back at home or back in Fiji. And we go from there. It's like it takes the 6 months or the whole year. It's just writing, receiving, sending, and yeah. And I didn't even know until I came from the other side of Fiji back to my homeland, which is Viti Levu. And my mom said, can you go this Sunday and just tell your dad that you are leaving? And I said, leaving where? I said, you're leaving Fiji, you're going abroad. I said, what? Yeah, yeah. So mom hidden all that for me. So he said that for my 21st birthday, it's a gift. So when I came here, I was already 23.
Your mother's 21st birthday gift was to join the British Army. What did you think about that?
I will never, ever forget it. Will never, ever forget that for the rest of my life. Yeah, not only that, as my older brother came before me, he came and joined the Royal Scots. Mm-hmm. So he was in Scotland.
How did he feel about joining a Scottish regiment?
I said to him, when he I was still back in Fiji when he called, and he said, you know what, the culture here is, the dress code here is similar to Fiji. We have Sulu, we have a skirt. Yeah, and I said, oh, yeah, the gill, but that gill is thicker than the one we have in Fiji because of the weather difference.
So there are some 3,500 Fijians living in Britain today, and of that population, 1,500 to 2,000 of them are the unsung heroes of the British Army. You must be very proud to be part of that heritage.
Very proud, sir, even though we are citizens as a family. We are citizens here and are proudly to be called Fijians still, even though we've been here for more than 20 years. And yeah, Fijian will always be with us for the rest of our lives. But we are proudly served here, and we thank this country for letting us come to this place or come give us opportunities for not only for us, as for our kids in the future, of the Fijian soldiers who come and join the British Army.
You served in far, far from home in Afghanistan and Iraq. How did you find fighting for a cause that as a Fijian, you have perhaps little association with, yet you find yourself fighting for the British Army overseas? How was that?
Yeah, you know, as a private soldier at that time, we just basically do what we're told, and we are proudly served, because when we go there, we don't see us as a Fijian. We see us as we are British soldiers. Yes, so there's ups and downs inside the army, though. But, you know, to be honest with you, we are really proud, and we thank, thank the nation, thank the country that Fiji can be in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere as well.
Balurunka Badan, the song of the Assam Regiment of the Indian Army. But to understand the tales of today, it is important to remember the tales of yesterday. Military historian Gordon Corrigan, who served with the 6th Gurkha Rifles, discusses the Empire's participation in the First World War.
In 1914, the position was that if the King declared war, then automatically the whole of the Empire was at war. The British Army was the only all-professional volunteer force of all the players. All the other European countries manned their armies, mass armies of conscripts. Not the case in the British Army. Now, the result was that the men that went across in the British Expeditionary Force in 1914 to Belgium and France, it was said at the time, it's been said since, that they were the finest led, the finest trained, and the finest body of troops ever to leave these shores. And I think that is correct. But it was pitifully small. Only 4 infantry divisions compared to 60 infantry divisions that the French fielded in 1914. After the retreat from Mons, it was evident that the British Army was going to need replacements. In the meantime, the only source of trained, regular manpower was the Indian Army. The Indian Army was the only reasonably large army in the empire. It was about 200,000 strong. And it, too, of course, would expand. But in the meantime, that was the only source of trained, regular manpower to reinforce the British Army. So in 1914, 2 Indian divisions and an Indian cavalry brigade came across in 1914. They arrived just in time and just enough numbers to fill the gaps in the First Battle of Ypres and prevent the Germans from getting to the Channel ports. They'd certainly saved the BEF. The Indian Army was entirely volunteer. It would remain, unlike the other dominions, it would remain all volunteer right until the end of the war. There was never conscription in India. The point in the Indian Army was that they were recruited from what were known as the martial classes. But that's the way the Indian Army worked. And so they were always volunteer. And of course, they expanded enormously. They were not only involved on the Western Front, they were, of course, involved in Mesopotamia, in Palestine, guarding the Suez Canal, and in Gallipoli, and of course, in Salonika. So they expanded about 10 times during the war. They were just short of 2 million by the end of the war.
The Great Little Army, the quick march of the Canadian Army, composed by the great Kenneth Alford, played by the Royal Canadian Artillery Band.
The Canadian Army pre-war was composed of a very small cadre of professional officers and NCOs, and the rest of Canadian Defence was based on a militia system, part-time units, and it took time to get those trained and ready to go abroad. And Canada produced 4 divisions on the Western Front. Very useful they were too. So no conscription there, 4 divisions on the Western Front, very effective divisions they were too. Australia, again, all volunteers. New Zealand sent 1 division to the Western Front. Of course, they went to Gallipoli as well. The New Zealanders who went to Gallipoli and the Australians who went to Gallipoli were all volunteers. There were no conscripts at that point. And the contribution was enormous. Could we have won the war without the Empire? We could have. We would eventually, probably, thanks to the Royal Navy, have starved Germany into surrender. But it would have taken an awful lot longer. So the and particularly, of course, the war in the Middle East was Mesopotamia, almost entirely an Indian war. And of course, there was an Indian division sent to Persia to look after the oil.
Waltzing Matilda, with lyrics by Banjo Paterson to a tune composed from memory by Christina McPherson, played by the Australian Army Band, Sydney. And so to Stansted Airport, for lunch with my old comrade, founder of Flypop Airline, and former Army officer, Nino Singh Judge, whose forebear, Karamjit Singh Judge, was awarded the Victoria Cross posthumously for his great bravery under fire in the Burma campaign while serving as a platoon commander with the 4th Battalion, the 15th Punjab Regiment, in March 1945 at the age of 21. We talk about Sikhism, the proud Sikh military tradition.
You yourself joined the British Army. What was the motivation behind that?
I remember my father used to say to me, never start a fight, but always end it. Doesn't seem very religious, and we carry kirpans in our swords.
Yeah.
But it literally is, there's none of this turn the other cheek, which surprises a lot of people.
Yeah.
And my parents never encouraged me to join the armed forces, but when the old chap came from Welbeck to recruit, suddenly the penny dropped. What a great thing to do. And it was a great way to get out of Luton, to be honest. But it was getting an education. For me, it was a great way to accelerate being British. And I didn't realise, to this day, best thing I ever did, to serve my country and contribute as a loyal Sikh, ticks all the boxes.
Drums of the 15th Punjab beat retreat in 1941. The Proud Family Regiment of the Singh Judges. Journalist Christopher Somerville offers an insight to the 5 million Commonwealth citizens who fought for the Allies in the Second World War, and 170,000 who died or went missing in action.
And the actual individuals who made up those 5 million Commonwealth citizens who volunteered to join the fight against Hitler, those people were, they obviously had to make up their individual minds to join. And what was fascinating was the different motives they had. Some of them are motives it would be quite hard, perhaps, for some people today to credit, like emotional attachment to the old country. And those weren't just, you know, white Australians who'd been out in Australia for a couple of generations. Those were Africans and Indians and Caribbean people and all over the world. It was an extraordinary response.
This attachment, it's almost, I mean, Hitler and Japan were remote entities as far as they were concerned. And they were putting themselves, they were laying their lives down for a cause which in many cases they had no reason to. It is above and beyond the call of duty in that sense, isn't it?
Well, this is very interesting. The variety of reasons for joining were extraordinary. Some of it was just what you might call patriotism. Some of it was, this man, Hitler, he's doing this to the Jews. What's he going to do to us if he comes to our country? So there was that strong feeling. Also, there was the fact that they were young men and women, desperate to get away from home, have some fun, have some adventure, zoom into the other side of the world. Some of them, it was a financial question, or even actually a food question, like Paul Gobin of the Seychelles, who said, I will get 3 square meals a day in barracks, and I won't if I stay at home. There was this whole basket of reasons that brought these young people together from all over the world for this one cause.
Welsh actor, comedian, writer and TV presenter Griff Rhys-Jones recalls his father, Elwyn Rhys-Jones, who, freshly qualified from Cardiff Royal Infirmary, travelled 15,000 miles from Wales to Ghana to take up an appointment as a regimental medical officer in the Gold Coast Regiment, part of the 82nd West African Division, who would defeat the Japanese in the fierce fighting of the Burma Campaign as part of Field Marshal Slim's 14th Army.
Serving the 82nd West African Division in 1944 in Burma, he had a great affinity with the Ghanaians and the Sierra Leoneans and all those wonderful people who volunteered so bravely to fight for the nation.
This is an important thing to understand. When I went to Ghana, the British Embassy actually organised what they quite regularly did was a sort of veterans' evening. They were all very old men and they'd roll up. They were very, very anxious to tell me that they were not conscripted, that they were volunteers. But a lot of these guys certainly didn't look back on it as the idea that in some way they were exploited.
What was your father's take on working with the Gold Coast Regiment? You must have been very fond of them, was he?
Well, I think he was, but I mean, it was a passage in his life that obviously fascinated his six-year-old and 10-year-old boys. But I think, like a lot of veterans, and this is a bit of a cliche, he didn't really talk about it. I think a lot of his stories were about his men and he told them with affection. You know, there's no doubt about that. But my father was sent down through the western side of Burma. There's a ridge of hills that runs down. And so that's on the coastal side, the Arakan side. And that, I believe, is where the West African regiments were largely used. The problem for a doctor, I think, was that in some of the jungle conditions, an operating theatre, the surgeon would be picking, you know, leeches out of the wounds as he was operating.
You make light of your father not being at Kohima, but actually he was in the thick of it for quite a lot of the Burma campaign after that, and some of the very heavy fighting. Did he ever tell you about how that was?
No. That came as quite a considerable surprise. I think it must have been pretty difficult because they came down, you know, unopposed, as it were. Although, as we know, if anybody's read about the campaign in Burma, when you can only see 6 feet in front of you, you know, and you're not even that, and you're sort of pressing on into the jump with the knowledge, and this is the sort of experience that people had all the time, that somewhere you might suddenly just find yourself in the middle of a firefight, not even see the people who are attacking you. But they came through, and I think they went up into the hills. There was a pass to get over the mountains and into what would be the plains of southern Myanmar. And it was at that pass that the Japanese army took a stand, and there was a battle there. And my father was in the battle, which took a large number of casualties, and he would have been responsible as the regimental medical officer for triage and in the thick of it, sort of, you know.
Trying to get every sort of...
Yeah.
What's your take on the Commonwealth involvement, huge contribution to the war effort and the sacrifice made by all those brave men and women?
I think it's taken quite a long time for people to realise what a contribution the British expected its empire to make. I don't know how confusing it must have been for soldiers recruited in Ghana to find themselves shipped out across two oceans to go and fight people that they didn't know at all. But it's patronising for people to imply that they had no idea what was going on. An army of 1 million men, which they finally put together, that's a huge thing. But people don't understand what war really constitutes when it becomes a world war.
In an interview recorded 4 years ago for VJ Day 75, Joseph Hammond, now 99 years old, from Accra in Ghana, explains why he volunteered to fight with the 3rd Battalion, the Gold Coast Regiment, in Burma.
We were there for a purpose. we were sent there by the British. They were at war, and it was our duty to help them. We cannot leave them alone to perish. It was not our war. But if you have a friend and he's suffering, you have to help him.
Ghanaian drumming performance by Kofi Fuga and the Walla Group. Christopher Somerville talks of the patriotism of the wartime generation.
Almost all, without fail, said we felt safe growing up under the colonial system. We thought of England or Britain as home. We're going home. We'd have a letter from home, but we've written home. That would be an extremely rare thing to hear nowadays, but you have to consider that that was a generation.
It is fair to say that without their great help and our selfless contribution, we couldn't have done it without them, could we?
No, we couldn't. Absolutely not. I think that the fact that all these people came to help defeat this monstrous thing which is threatening the world, it's very rare that it's properly remembered. And that's partly because not enough fuss, if you like, was made of it, and because the people themselves were disinclined to speak about it. In wartime, if you shot a line, if you bragged about something, everybody told you to shut up.
The Haka, performed by members of the New Zealand Defence Force at the Menin Gate, Ypres, on Anzac Day 2016. In 1950, a British Commonwealth force, including Australian, British, Canadian, Indian and New Zealand units, deployed to Korea, with subsequent similar involvement on operations in the 1960s. But what of the duty of care that we had for many millions around the globe who volunteered to fight on Britain's behalf? The Army Benevolent Fund, in conjunction with the Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office, provides long-term financial assistance to support the Welfare Aid Programme of the Royal Commonwealth Ex-Services League for pre-independence Commonwealth veterans and their widows. David Thompson, Secretary-General of the Royal Commonwealth Ex-Services League.
In the Second World War, the contribution of the Empire was huge. So there were about 8 million British Empire troops, including the British Armed Forces, of which 5 million were from what is now the Commonwealth, and 2.5 of those million came from pre-partition India. So there was a very, very sizable Commonwealth, then Empire, contribution to the war effort. And so the League found itself very busy after the Second World War. And to be honest, we are still, I suppose, living with the legacy of that now, in the sense that we still have a number of Second World War veterans still alive who we support. Now, our offer is very much focused on food grants. So we provide 2 meals a day, a nutritious diet, to pre-independence veterans. So those individuals who served the British Crown prior to their country's independence, and we also support eligible widows. So last year, about 3,500, and this year it'll be a little over 3,000 people that we will support with food grants across a number of Commonwealth countries. And again, I should say here that the Royal British Legion, the Army Benevolent Fund, the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund, and the Royal Navy have been incredibly supportive of the programme and have provided funds also to help us support our mutual beneficiaries.
Tax Jalan Perang, the war dance of the Malaysian Army's 10th Parachute Brigade. Christopher Somerville reminded that without the enormous contribution of the Commonwealth, the outcome of the Second World War may have been very different indeed. Just as at present, Commonwealth citizens form a sizable part of our armed forces, without which their operational effectiveness would be much reduced. But Christopher also remarked that the voluntary involvement, commitment, and sacrifice made by the Commonwealth is often, dare I say, overlooked, or worse, forgotten altogether. But memorials such as the Chantry on the Downs above Brighton, or the Commonwealth Gates on Constitutional Hill in London, stand as beacons, lest we forget the heritage we share with the many races, faiths and creeds of the United Kingdom, whose forebears all fought for Great Britain and the freedoms we enjoy today. Omar Sheikh of Colourful Heritage, the charity preserving South Asian and Muslim heritage in Scotland, talks of the plans to build a memorial to the British Indian Army in the grounds of Glasgow's Kelvin Grove Art Gallery, a vital pan-community project not just to remember, but to create greater understanding.
We felt it's critical to put a befitting memorial together for these soldiers, but we also felt, more importantly, that the memorial is not an end, it's a means to an end. And for the last 5-6 years, Dr. Sakib and friends supporting us have been out to nearly 7,000 school kids with school packs that have been made together with Glasgow Museums to teach primary school kids, principally the kind of early secondary school age groups, about the contributions of the British Indian Army. And it was through that process of education and awareness that it was so obvious that there's a huge gap here. And one of the things we thought that we could do to further this is actually have Scotland's a national memorial in Scotland as a permanent feature that the school children and others can go and pay their respects to and visit and find out more about it. We launched the campaign a few years ago with BBC, and we got out there and we actually did a massive consultation process and got nearly 200 school kids out to contribute their design ideas, their drawings and what they would like to see. We wanted it to reflect everyone from India, all the different faith groups that come from there, but also the Scottishness as well, and the Scottish, particularly individuals in the Scottish community as well, who had played a meaningful role, like Isabel Harling and others. We went out to the faith institutions, we got everyone involved, and we came together with this design similar to the Chantry, which actually resembles and is inspired by some of the existing architecture in Kelvin Grove Museum, the most stunning building on the west end of Glasgow. Right. Again, through consultation, the design features within the Chantry, the reflection of the faith symbols, the narrative that sits around it, is actually quite intriguing and interesting. And there's a piece of work we're working on right now. If we can get sufficient funding to do it, we want to actually make a kind of virtual equivalent. So it's integrated with QR codes so that when schools go or young children go, they can actually scan the physical architecture and then enter a gateway into a whole new digital world as to who these soldiers were.
Traditional dance from Gabon, who along with Togo were the latest nations to join the Commonwealth in 2022. Former Chief of the General Staff, General the Lord Dannett.
Looking back to the First World War and the Second World War and the score of conflicts since 1945, that so many who have come from the Commonwealth were prepared to rally to the cause of freedom and democracy and to fight with such determination and vigour and commitment and valour for the right ideals in the 20th century. I think it's a wonderful thing that this is now being remembered, commemorated, and celebrated. Into
the northeast pier of the Commonwealth Gates on London's Constitution Hill is a quotation from that great man of letters, Sir Ben Okri. Our future is greater than our past. It is with enormous gratitude and honour that the Commonwealth has played such a significant and selfless role in the defence of freedom since the First War, relentlessly rallying to our cry, often above and beyond the call of duty. That so many citizens of the Commonwealth continue to serve in the ranks of our armed forces today is a source of great pride. Never underestimate how much you value that contribution, nor the great sacrifice made on our behalf, nor that which continues to be made by the Commonwealth today. Thank you. And on behalf of the service community, we at the Army Benevolent Fund salute you all. But the last word goes to 99-year-old Private Joseph Hammond in Ghana.
I feel very proud, very, very proud that I took part in the war. I feel very proud. I think about peace now. I don't think about war anymore. And we must try assiduously to ensure that no war come on again, no war again. We must try assiduously, because war is never good.
And with thanks to everyone who so kindly contributed to the making of this programme. Sepoys in the Trenches by Gordon Corrigan, Our War by Christopher Somerville, and Victory to Defeat by General Lord Dannett and Dr. Robert Lyman are available for purchase online. For further details of Scotland's British Indian Army Memorial, or to donate, please visit colourfulheritage.com. The Commonwealth Anthem was performed by the Commonwealth Children's Choir and the Band of the Coalition Guards under the musical direction of Major Simon Hoare. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to learn more about the work of the Army Benevolent Fund, please visit armybenevolentfund.org. Studio editing was by Michael Stiglianu. Series editors were Jenny Redman and Natasha Theobald. This has been a Gamekeeper production for the Army Benevolent Fund.